How do I get rid of that slideshow sign? Okay. First, we'll do a historical overview of some of the theories concerning biology and embryological development. Then we're going to examine some views of the soul. Ted's already given us some introduction. And I want to talk about its relationship to the physical body by some of the philosophical and religious schools. I am not going to be looking at non-Western traditions. I don't have time to do that. So we're not going to talk about Buddhism or Hinduism or Taoism or any of those. And finally, we'll try and put the two threads together. And in that process, we will be looking at some ethical and some theological implications. Living things reproduce themselves. And now, that's pretty obvious. We're all here. But how do they reproduce and what happens? Throughout history, there's been essentially three answers to that. Spontaneous generation, asexual reproduction, or parthenogenesis, and sexual reproduction. Again, I'm not going to deal with spontaneous generation or parthenogenesis. That doesn't relate to what I want to do today. We're going to be talking about how philosophers and scientists explain the biological development of the next generation of human beings. In the Hippocratic writings, there's one short work called The Seed, which explains human generation this way. During coitus, seminal fluids or semen from both the male and the female mix and solidify, resulting in the generation of an embryo within the uterus. The semen formation draws fluids that contain miniature representative structures from all of the parts of the body. This is a mechanism known as pangenesis, which Darwin is going to use centuries later to try and explain heredity. And in the mixed seed of the male and the female, these are retained in the womb, and because of the woman's heat, they are mixed together and condensed, and they acquire air and breath, and then expand and form a membrane around the new entity. The process of formation of limbs, organs, and the like goes faster in males than in females. It takes approximately 42 days in the case of the female, but only 30 in the days for the male. This varies from individual to individual, but in general, that's the case. Once the fetus is formed, the ends of the limbs, the nails, and the hair start to grow. Only then does the embryo begin to move. That's around 3 months for males and 4 months for females. And as David Jones has pointed out, the Hippocratic embryology had three major points of transition: the process of reproduction, development, and growth are all explained in going from formed to unformed, from differentiated to differentiated in a process called epigenesis. That's the Hippocratics. Plato doesn't talk a lot about how babies are born. So we'll go to Aristotle. Aristotle had an elaborate theory of generation. He distinguished viviparous and oviparous animals, which come into being from the union of male and female, and he distinguished those from those that come into being from decaying earth and excrements, in other words, spontaneous generation. His theory of sexual generation is based on male and female principles, and these are called efficient causes and material causes. He rejected pangenesis. He thought that was a stupid argument. The menstrual blood constitutes the material residue for creating the embryo, while an ethereal constituent of male semen provides a motion or animating force that introduces the immaterial soul or anima. embryological development was viewed by Aristotle and by later Aristotelians as a sort of chain reaction caused by the power of the male parent conveyed by the spirit or breath, the pneuma, that causes the embryo to be transformed and to develop. The organs form in a progressive development one by one, starting with the heart, the brain, and the liver. The inner organs are formed before the outer limbs, the upper part of the embryo before the lower. The shaping of the internal organs and limbs of the embryo from head to toe is completed in about 40 days for the male embryo and 90 for the female. For male children, the first movement usually occurs on the right side of the womb, and for females, it starts on the left side. Once again, though, we have an epigenetic view of embryological development. Excuse me. The famous Roman physician Galen, who lived in the 2nd century AD, borrowed heavily from both the Hippocratics and Aristotle, and talked about an animating male principle and assumed that the female menstrual blood constituted the material for the embryo. But unlike the Hippocratics, Galen used faculties, qualities, and other non-mechanistic ways to explain the changes that took place. He said, for example, that the uterus has a retentive faculty that holds the embryo inside. And he explained the differentiation of parts by inventing a principle of proportionate attraction. Like the Hippocratic writers and Aristotle, Galen affirmed epigenesis. Throughout the Middle Ages, views on embryological development were primarily a mixture of the ideas of Hippocratic writers, Aristotle, and Galen. And most importantly, they were epigenetic. So that is going to go up until about 17th century. Now, in the 17th and 18th century, a new theory appeared called preformationism. Preformation theories generally asserted that new individuals, or at least their component parts, occur prefabricated in the parental body prior to birth. Generation might take place through the mixing of male and female semen or simply by a preformed embryo pre-existing as a germ inside one of the parents. If it existed inside the female, it was called ovism. If it existed inside the male, it was called animalculism. An alternative preformation theory depicted an uninterrupted chain of pre-existent beings and maintained that all complex organic forms had existed since creation. In Adam or Eve, all future generations existed, encased in the parent of the previous generation, like Russian nesting dolls. This theory was termed embwatment. Now, preformation was not just a speculative theory. The Italian physician Marcello Malpighi, the Dutch physician and microscopist John Swammerdam, Caspar Wolff, a German considered to be one of the founders of embryology, and numerous other natural philosophers conducted rigorous experiments on chicken eggs, chrysalides of butterflies, and other organisms seeking to understand the process of development. Shirley Rowe, in her book Matter, Life, and Generation, describes the meticulous and careful work of Wolff and explains why his observations supported his preformationist views. Now, there were both scientific and philosophical, theological reasons to reject epigenesis and adopt preformationism. With the rise of mechanical philosophy in the 17th century, the epigenetic theory came under attack. Now, Ted knows much more about mechanistic philosophy than I do. So, Ted, my definition is going to be very broad and nonspecific. But mechanical philosophy sought to explain all natural phenomena in terms of matter and motion without any reliance on action at a distance. The British historian of science, John Hedley Brooks, wrote that the basic postulate of the mechanical philosophies was that nature operates according to mechanical principles, the regularity of which can be expressed in the form of natural laws, ideally formulated in mathematical terms. There was no mechanism, no way of explaining the changes in the embryo during development through natural processes available for epigenetic explanations. We didn't know how to talk about going from unformed to formed. If one assumed, however, that the embryo did not pass through developmental stages, like the Hippocratics and Aristotle and Galen taught, but was already completely formed and all that one had to do was grow, well, that we could deal with. Preformationism also addressed certain theological issues. One of the implications that some natural philosophers and theologians drew from mechanical philosophy was that the universe was static. All entities, all individuals were understood to have come into being at the initial time of creation, and God's relationship to the universe now was explained more often in deistic than in theistic terms. Preformationism fit much more fully with that view than epigenesis did. Now, although William Harvey and René Descartes both still held to epigenesis, little can be found in the literature during the 17th and 18th century supporting epigenesis, except for the work of the French mathematician Pierre-Louis Moreau de Maupertuis. He wrote a book called Venus Physique. He meticulously dissected preformation theories by ridiculing the logical consequences of certain assumptions. He sought to explain the sequential development of embryonic form by analogy to recently established principles of chemical attraction, gravitation, and magnetism. In other words, he tried to give a mechanical basis for epigenesis. And virtually no one believed him. They basically thought he was, well, just being funny. Epigeneticists had major problems explaining the factors controlling individual development. They found no mechanisms, and so generally had to rely on special developmental forces. In other words, they had to appeal to unknown forces to explain their theories. William Coleman argues that the triumph of epigenesis came with the work of Heinrich Christian Pander, Carl von Baer in Germany. Pander was able to show the development of the hen's egg from unformed primordium to the hatching of the chick. And while the spermatozoa was discovered in the late 17th century, the mammalian egg was not discovered until 1827 by von Baer. Until the 1870s, it was believed that the sperm contributed only an excitation, a stimulus to the egg's development. However, in 1876-1877, Oskar Hertwig, a German cytologist, and Hermann Fold, a Swiss zoologist, observed the sperm penetrating the egg, two nuclei in the egg, and the fusion of the two nuclei to form the unique nucleus in the fertilized cell. So, by the end of the 19th century, biology had a descriptive model of epigenetic embryological development, but no mechanistic one. Forces, vital spirits, and the like were used without any theological reference because scientists were unable to explain development in any other way. The discipline remained essentially descriptive until the latter part of the 20th century with the modern field of evo-devo, evolutionary development, and that field began to emerge and is still to some extent seeking to formulate an overarching theory But the current paradigm assumes that evolution takes a particular gene or gene network and reworks it to create a new structure. So, for instance, the bone structure of the jaw is transformed into the ossicles of the middle ear. Or, Ivo Divo says, it can conserve a genetic program and use it in a variety of organisms. So in eye development genes, we can see that in jellyfish, insects, and mammals. All right, let's leave our embryo for a while and take a look at ensoulment. To do so, we need to understand what various philosophers and theologians have understood the soul to be, and when and how it becomes related to the physical body. And again, because of a limited time, I'm going to give general summaries of three positions that are important for Christian theology, and this will be sort of like you would find in an encyclopedia. For Plato, another dualist, the soul, or the psyche, is immortal, immaterial, and changeless. While Plato generally viewed the soul as simple, that is, not capable of being divided, in some of his works he also talked about the tripartite nature of the soul. He used the analogy of the chariot with a driver, reason, a well-behaved white horse, the will, and one badly behaved black horse, the appetites or passions. Reason's job was to control the will and the appetites and provide a unity of function. In this view, of this side of Plato's image, only reason is changeless. But this view of Plato also explains why some later philosophers began to identify soul with mind. Most scholars interpret Plato's views to be that the soul becomes related to the body at birth. Aristotle's view of soul is quite different from Plato's. For Aristotle, soul is probably more accurately defined as a life-giving force. Soul is what makes something a living something. It is the directing force of any living organism, and it does not exist apart from matter or body. It is what makes actual the potential of matter. All living things have souls, but the quality or type of souls is different among organisms. Plants have nutritive souls. Animals have nutritive and locomotor souls. And humans have nutritive, locomotor, and rational souls. It is the possession of a rational soul that makes a human different from an animal. At conception, an embryo has only a nutritive soul. As it develops, it gains the locomotory soul and finally the rational soul. This humanizing soul requires about 40 days of embryological development for males and about 90 for females. We just are too slow, aren't we? And its arrival is characterized or associated by quickening. Now, Aristotle makes clear that the potential for this arrives much earlier. He says it's about 1 week after conception, the potential for coming to this humanizing portion of the soul is there, but it is not there until 40 or 90 days. Now, a third influence on Christian thought was Judaism. And although later Hebraic thought was also affected by Greek thought, there are some major distinctions. Like Aristotle, early Jewish views did not see body and soul as distinct. In Genesis 2, we have a description of God forming man from the dust of the ground and then breathing into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being or living soul. Nephesh. Moreover, living creatures, that is the animals that were formed in Genesis 1, 20, 21, and 24, all possess nephesh. This word in the various forms can mean soul, life, person, living being, blood, desire, breath, and a few other things as well. In this context, nephesh has a meaning very similar to soul as life force in Aristotelian thought. However, at times it is used to mean a human person or human persons. Early Jewish thought believed in a manner similar to that of Aristotle that the nephesh could not survive death. But if nephesh came from God, how could it not survive? Well, two approaches were used to answer this question. One was to connect nephesh with emotions, especially love. This view of nephesh involved not only morality, so you love your neighbor as yourself, but also worship, love God with all your soul, nephesh, and might. To love someone literally connects your soul to that person's soul, or your nephesh to God's nephesh. God's connection to a person's soul meant that God would, in the words of Psalm 49:15, ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. The other approach to answer the question took a more Platonic position. Adherents to this position believed that all souls were created at the beginning of time and stored in a place in heaven until birth. Here again, though, there is a division of thought. Some say that the soul has the first attachment to the body at the moment of conception in Jewish thought and remains with the body until the moment of death. Other Jewish groups say that the soul does not arrive until birth, when the first breath is taken, and it departs when breath ceases. Summarizing these three influences, we note that Plato, Aristotle, and some Jewish groups held the view of delayed ensoulment for humans. That is, that there is a period of time between the conception of the embryo and the soul being with the body. For Plato and some Jewish groups, the time lag was about 9 months, the entire gestational period, since it arrives with first breath. For Aristotle, the delay was much shorter and was evidenced by quickening. Plato believed that the soul was an object independent from the body, and after death, it would continue in the spiritual realm. For him, the soul is a personal soul, the essence of a person, that which makes an individual person a unique person, and it is the soul that will continue a person's existence after death. For Aristotle and some Jews, the soul does not exist apart from the body. Aristotle taught that the soul has little to do with personal identity or individuality. Moreover, since it cannot exist apart from matter, it is not immortal. The influential 2nd century Roman physician Galen accepted both Aristotle's understanding of epigenesis and, the 15th and 16th century saw a revival of Neoplatonism, which opposed both the entrenched Aristotelianism of the universities and the incipient strains of materialism that were arising through Europe. Concerned by the teachings of some of the perceived anti-Christian teachings of some Aristotelian clerics, Pope Leo X issued a bull in 1513 as a part of the Fifth Lateran Council, articulating explicitly for the first time the immortality of the soul as a Roman Catholic doctrine. John Calvin made clear in his Institutes on the Christian Religion that Plato was one of the sounder philosophers. He was not a Platonist himself, but he borrowed Platonic language to explain Christian truth, according to one scholar. By the 17th century, this Neoplatonic influence could be found well established in the Cambridge Platonists, in the philosophy of René Descartes and his followers, and in our preformationist adherents. For them, the soul was an immortal, immaterial, spiritual entity imposed by God on the now ready to develop embryo at conception. Animation was no longer identified with quickening, but rather with conception. Descartes, while not a preformationist, advocated this more Platonic view of the soul, and as Ted has pointed out, knew where the soul is united to the body, the pineal gland. None of these views explain the origin of the soul, just when the embryo was ensouled. Again, very briefly, there were two major positions on the origin of the soul, creationism and traducianism. The creationist position initially and most articulately, most clearly articulated by Jerome, held, or more accurately holds, that God creates a new soul for each embryo. Traducianism, the position defended by Tertullian, teaches that each individual soul is connected to the soul that Adam received. Creationism was the dominant position through the Middle Ages, but Traducianism never disappeared and was revived by Martin Luther and is still a favored doctrine of many Lutheran theologians. Well, let's put together what we have so far. From the Hippocratic writers through the Middle Ages, the biological theory for embryological development was epigenetic. Ensoulment was delayed, and the soul was understood more in the terms of Aristotelian and Jewish life force, but baptized with Christian ideas relating to personality and the resurrection of the body. As a result, Roman Catholic doctrines prior to the Reformation were based on these views. While the teachings on abortion varied, two points are very clear. The embryo was not considered human before quickening, and arguments against abortion related more to the purpose and function of sex and marriage than they did to the sanctity of the embryo's life. For example, in his St. Augustine wrote, "But with regard to the undeveloped fetuses, who would not more readily think that they perish like seeds that did not germinate?" Aquinas taught that the embryo had to develop until it was apt for the reception of the human soul from God, passing through stages that involved a vegetative soul and an animative soul first. In 1140, Gratian compiled the first authoritative collection of canon laws, and the canon Quando concluded that, quote, abortion was homicide only if the fetus was formed. The rule of the church until 1869 was issued by Gregory XIV in 1591. In his Sedes Apostolica, he advised church officials that where no homicide or no animated fetus is involved, not to punish more strictly than the sacred canons or civil legislations does. Now, with the advent of mechanistic philosophy and preformationism, and influenced by the revival of Neoplatonism, the idea of delayed ensoulment became problematic. If the individual was already preformed, then it made logical and theological sense that the soul arrived at conception. The various forms of Aristotelian developing souls were abandoned for an already created Platonic soul, although this soul became more and more identified with mind, a la Descartes. This change in paradigm meant, as I said earlier, that quickening or animation was no longer the point of homonization, but rather conception. Protestants, whose theology was less tied to Aristotle via tradition and the church fathers, rejected all forms of abortion. And David Jones points out that the required revisions in a number of doctrines resulted from this. Those doctrines included original sin, predestination, and imputed righteousness. Anti-abortion sentiments were also growing among Roman Catholics, and in 1886, Pope Leo XIII issued a decree that prohibited all procedures that directly killed the fetus, even if done to save the woman's life. 19th and 20th century work in the biological sciences created problems for the religious communities, as we are all aware. Darwinism impacted the way religious communities looked at embryological findings, however, especially following the publication of Ernst Haeckel's system of ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny. For some, these ideas were anathema, and Pope Leo XIII's decree was probably related to ideas surrounding Darwin and Haeckel. For others, changes in science required a rethinking of theological positions. For instance, Karl Rahner, the German Roman Catholic theologian, determined that scientific findings required a return to the Aristotelian Thomistic doctrine of delayed ensoulment, and such a doctrine was consistent with both embryological and evolutionary development. As one entered the 20th century then, there were essentially three positions regarding the embryo and the soul. In substance dualism, the soul as a complete and separate entity is immediately connected to the embryo at conception. In dual aspect theory, the soul is emergent, and there is a delay between the fertilization of the egg and the point at which the soul is present. Materialists deny the existence of the soul, and therefore the ensoulment of the embryo is irrelevant. In the 20th century, the discipline of neuroscience began to influence ideas about the soul, including the arrival of the, including its arrival in the embryo. Influenced both by Descartes' conflation of soul and mind, and by the Aristotelian concept of the rational soul as unique to humans, philosophers and theologians began to relate the presence of brain waves to hominization and the presence or absence of the soul. This relationship was seen first not at the beginning of life, but with the end of life. Brain death, the absence of brain waves, became accepted as a medical and legal definition of death, and by extension, the departure of the soul. The logical implication of this view was that the presence of brain waves implied the presence of the soul. The latest research I have seen indicates that the neocortex portion of the brain begins development around the 8th week and has all of the neuronal cells by the 20th week, with synaptic connections developing between the 20th and 24th week. Using this understanding of soul gives credence to the dual aspect theory. Another influence, although less well known by the general public, comes from studies of pregnancies and spontaneous abortions by the reproductive medical community. A growing body of research indicates that up to 50% of all conceptions are spontaneously aborted before a woman knows that she is pregnant, and another 15 to 20% are aborted after implantation. Let me clarify that these studies do not include the stopping of a pregnancy as a result of the morning after pill. These are conceptions that are naturally not continued. Ethicists, philosophers, and theologians studying these data find them difficult to reconcile with the doctrine of immediate ensoulment. So where does that leave us? Both substance dualism and dual aspect theory adherents can be found today within the Christian community. The common cultural understanding, both in the church and in outside the church, however, is the Platonic view of the soul, or substance dualism. The embryo or fetus gets a soul, and the soul departs, or for Christians, is resurrected after death. Humans are distinct from animals because humans have souls. This goes back to the continuity question. These are souls that were provided either when Adam and Eve were created or when we evolved to a point that we were given human souls. I find this Platonic view and its implications theologically and scientifically unsettling. Theologically, I think it conflates the concept of soul with the doctrine of Imago Dei, the image of God, and implies that the Imago Dei is something God gives rather than being something that he made us. We are humans, both phylogenetically and ontologically, because we are created in God's image. But what does that mean? What does it mean to be created in the image of God? And I was really hoping that Ted would give me that answer so I didn't have to... The well-known authority on Jewish history, language, and customs of the Old Testament, Charles Lee Feinberg, provided a good background on various interpretations given to this concept, but almost all of them involve two qualities, rationality and the ability to relate to others and to God. The BioLogos website that Francis Collins has put up explains the image of God in this way. The fundamental qualities of the image of God are characteristics of the mind and soul, however we understand those. The ability to love selflessly, engage in meaningful relationships, exercise rationality, maintain dominion over the earth, and embrace moral responsibility. Now, if these characteristics are indeed valid descriptions for the image of God, then for humans, our bodies have to be involved. Rationality requires a brain. The ability to relate to others involves our body. And even our ability to relate to God is supposed to include our body. I would like to suggest that our soul is not a distinct substance from body, but rather a different way of looking at the same thing, and therefore, like our bodies, also develops epigenetically. Phylogenetically and ontologically, the life force, the nephesh, instilled by God, develops us until we exhibit the imago Dei. If this understanding is correct, I think it means that we need to reconsider the ways we formulate some of our ethical arguments with respect to the beginning and end of life, as well as how we discuss life after death. For example, anti-abortion and anti-embryonic stem cell arguments should not be based on the fertilized egg receiving a soul at conception. While not required, delay in soulment, meaning a delay in reaching that point of soul development that's required for us to be human or to be in the image of God, may mean that we have to think more in terms of potentiality if we're going to hold an anti-abortion or anti-embryonic rather than it already has it. On the other hand, and especially given the high percentage of spontaneous abortions, we may need to rethink the status of the fertilized egg and the implication that raises for our ethical decisions. Theologically, it means that we need to reaffirm and teach more clearly the doctrine of the resurrection of the body. Heaven is not filled with immortal souls. It is rather a realm in which God has resurrected us with heavenly spiritual bodies. The new creation parallels the first creation, but in a way in which the effects of sin are not present, either for us or for the rest of nature. That's the promise Paul speaks of in Romans when he says that creation itself will be set free. That's the assurance we see given throughout the New Testament. We are created. We are loved. We are saved. We will be resurrected, body and soul. Yes. I guess I would approach it this way. The soul, if the fertilized egg has a soul, there are going to be a lot of people in heaven that have never been on earth. And I find that just...
Well, a question. Then Paul says to be absent here, be present with the Lord. So he would, obviously that scenario is one in which Paul would bodily die, and yet he says that is to be present with the Lord. How do you reconcile?
But we're given spiritual bodies. In a twinkling of an eye, we're going to be changed.
Well, but the question is this. That's acknowledged. Paul says, of course, we will receive our spiritual bodies ultimately. But Paul says to be absent currently in the body is to be actually present with the Lord. It's the simultaneity of the death of this body before we receive our glorified bodies.
It's twinkling of an eye.
Right, but I'm saying the historical Christian theology is that we'll receive our permanent bodies, our glorified bodies, at the consummation of the age.
No, I don't.
I'm saying traditional Christian theology would indicate that. Okay, so you reject that altogether. So your view is that once we die, we immediately.
I don't believe in sleep and death a period of time between now.
I appreciate what you said about the Imago Dei and sort of the idea of rationality and relationship with others of God. How does that include the severely mentally disabled who don't have those properties? And what do we do there?
We are all in this life with marred Imago Dei. Some of us have a marred by moral problems. Well, we all have it more from sin, but that sin affects different aspects in which the Imago Dei can be expressed. And fortunately, that's going to be gone in heaven.
And how do you relate that to animals having certain levels of rationality?
Well, the more I worked on this, the more I began to say, maybe dogs are going to be in heaven. I mean, we know there's going to be trees, don't we? And I'll have to say, this is a work in process. I say, all right, there's some parallelism here between creation, the first creation, and the new creation that I think we haven't fully explored.
I have a minor footnote.
A minor footnote.
The word regenesis has a vigorous rebirth. And it has become a very important part of genetics. It's been, when genes were discovered, that it was assumed that their effect was pretty well set at conception. Far from that. The genes have to be expressed. Mm-hmm. The effect of the gene is modified by other genes.
Good point.
And the proteins. So simply saying, these words change.
Yeah.
And I have no idea whether that brings any new questions.
The way I'm thinking at it, it would make delayed ensoulment even more. Or I don't know if delayed ensoulment is even accurate because it's an epigenetic ensoulment.
It's just another part of
Use of reason seems to shift our understandings or change our understanding. So that shifts our understanding of what life is or when it starts or your theories. Do you find that distressing?
Doesn't change when life starts. A harmonization.
Your theories of ensoulment, let's say, shift based on reason.
I would say that reason is part of our Imago Dei. Soul is more life force that. Rod says that he's going to fill in the blanks for me. Okay, this is the last question. Brian?
What about in the issue or in the situation of or the fusion of two embryos is single embryo? Are you saying then that the soul as a genetic component is also developing into two souls during twinning or fusion?
Well, in the same way that matter is developing into two bodies.
We'll get to that too.
Rod's going to get to that too.